Quiz. Here on Radio 4 FM, Nancy Crane reads a fourth extract from Diane Hale's new book, Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered. As Mona Lisa comes of age in Florence, Leonardo da Vinci's reputation is growing in Milan.
The young artist from Vinci has grown from a beautiful boy into a stunning 27-year-old, looking as if he'd stepped out of a fresco in his purple and rose-colored robes, cut short to showcase his muscular legs. An early biographer describes him as very well-proportioned, graceful, and good-looking, with a beautiful head of hair that fell in golden ringlets to the middle of his chest. His father, Ser Piero, may have orchestrated some lucrative commissions in Florence, including an altarpiece in the chapel of the Palazzo Vecchio, which Leonardo never completed. From the very beginning of his career, the artist acquired a reputation for not meeting deadlines or delivering promised works, although not for lack of ability or ambition. In his notebook, Leonardo copied these lines from Dante: "He who uses up his life without achieving fame leaves no more vestige of himself on earth than smoke in the air or foam on the water." Leonardo was determined to become more than smoke or foam. "I wish to work miracles," he once wrote. But his miraculously creative designs were often so complex and technically demanding that he could not complete them. And he never won over the town's highbrow humanist intellectuals. To them, he may have seemed a gifted but unschooled ignoramus, incapable of even conversing in Latin. Then he suffered a galling snub. Pope Sixtus IV, reconciled with Il Magnifico, Lorenzo de' Medici, requested a list of the best artists in Florence to work on the Vatican Chapel, which would be named Sistine after him. Botticelli, Perugino, and a string of lesser painters packed their brushes and decamped to Rome for lucrative commissions. One man was conspicuously left behind, Leonardo da Vinci. Instead, Il Magnifico sent him off on a mission to Milan, commissioning him to create a gift for Duke Ludovico Sforza, an important ally, as a tribute. Sforza was impressed with him, but Leonardo was even more captivated by Milan, a prosperous big city of more than 80,000 residents that pulsed with energy. He proposed a stunning memorial to the Duke's father, a gigantic bronze statue that would be to the immortal glory and honor of the illustrious House of Sforza. Although he didn't win an immediate position on the Sforza payroll, Leonardo was convinced that his destiny lay in Milan and left Florence to live there in 1482. Lorenzo de' Medici did nothing to stop him. The following year, at age 4, Lisa Gherardini, the future Mona Lisa, became a big sister with the birth of her younger brother, followed by 5 more siblings in rapid succession. Each arrival must have increased the pressure on her father. His earnings were hardly enough to give him the dignified life expected of the landed gentry. As she grew older, her mother would have initiated her into all aspects of domestic life, including how to cook, clean, shop, haggle with vendors, and manage servants. As the big sister in a household that could afford little help, she undoubtedly did a full share of daily chores such as dusting, sweeping, and lending a hand in the kitchen. While Lisa Gherardini was still playing childhood games, her future partner, Francesco del Giocondo, was learning the daunting complexities of his family's trade in textiles. "Once I asked a Florentine friend of mine why her hometown, of all possible places, became the cradle of the Renaissance. Without a word, she carefully extracted a strand from a shawl tossed over her shoulders and held it before me. Il filo, the thread." Wool, the first fiber to enrich Florence, dominated the cloth market for centuries. Then the city swooned for seta when it was introduced from China. Light as a breeze, smooth as a petal, iridescent as sunshine. Florentine silk, epitomizing the elegance and refinement of the city itself, became the most coveted Renaissance luxury, more expensive even than precious gems. The city's silk business, including the Del Giocondo family's mills, grew into a multi-million dollar enterprise. Although most Renaissance garments have disintegrated over time, Florentine silks survive in the paintings of the artists who dressed Madonnas, saints, nobles, and well-to-do patrons in rich brocades and intricately worked silk velvets. The value of the cloth, an art historian writes, made the paintings more valuable. As a young man, Leonardo filled page after page of his notebooks with knots, braids, and patterns for textiles. I can't resist speculating that during his years in Florence, Leonardo may have consulted with artisan weavers, perhaps even those in the Del Giocondo shops. As the family business grew, young Francesco Del Giocondo leapfrogged over his older brothers to take the reins. Archivist Giuseppe Palanti categorizes him as a typical Florentine businessman, intelligent, sharp, and enterprising. His forceful handwriting attests to a strong personality. A trail of judicial filings against him reveals a darker side. In one court proceeding, the officers refer to him as an argumentative type, almost certainly an understatement. Palanti describes him as intolerant of rules and those who enforced them, but his general tendentiousness in no way hampered his commercial success, nor did they detract from his desirability as a potential husband. So, I kept asking as I continued my researches, how did Anton Maria Gherardini land such a groom for a daughter with no dowry, who was essentially unmarriageable? Perhaps it was because his short-lived first marriage to Camilla, the younger sister of Anton Maria's late wife, gave them a kinship bond that made it possible to weave their families more closely together. In the spring of 1492, a year after Francesco married Camilla Rucellai, dreadful omens chilled all of Florence. She-wolves howled at the moon. Strange lights flickered in the sky. Two of the city's prized lions, symbols of the city's strength, suddenly mauled each other to death in their cage. That same night, lightning struck the lantern atop the cathedral dome and dislodged one of the marble balls supporting it. The ball crashed to the pavement below and smashed to pieces. "In which direction did it fall?" asked Lorenzo de' Medici, now so debilitated with gout that he could no longer walk or even hold a pen. "To the northwest," he was told, "toward his house." "This means I shall die," he said. His healers tried an exotic concoction of pulverized pearls to cure him, but Lorenzo entered death's great sea on April 8, 1492. His doctor threw himself down a well in despair. As Il Magnifico's era ended, another began. The Italian explorer Christopher Columbus discovered what he thought were islands off the coast of India and launched the Age of Exploration. At the same time, the Del Giocondo brothers were also looking to new horizons. They formed a new partnership in Lyon and invoked, with a typical Florentine eye to both piety and profit, the immortal and omnipotent God, the Virgin Mary, and all the saints, so that their business affairs might enjoy a good start, better continuation, and excellent conclusion. Francesco's personal happiness soon rivaled his professional success. His wife Camilla brought to the light a healthy son named Bartolomeo. But 18 months later, in July 1494, Camilla was gone. The 19-year-old died, perhaps of a miscarriage, or perhaps from one of the age's ubiquitous infectious diseases. Neither power nor privilege could protect a young wife. As the aftershocks of Lorenzo's death reverberated through Florence, and the mighty Medici banking empire fell, far north in the court of Milan, Leonardo da Vinci was enjoying his wonder years. With supreme confidence, the ultimate Renaissance man was planning his massive bronze equestrian monument for the Duke Sforza. He had settled cozily into a refined court that shared his appreciation of physical beauty, good manners, and fine horses. With almost manic energy, as well as undertaking numerous commissions for paintings, Leonardo was on a quest to penetrate the secrets of light, water, air, dreams, madness, and even the location and nature of the soul. He calculated the ideal proportions for a human figure with the geometry of the ancient architect Vitruvius. He dreamed of flying like an eagle and drew up gravity-defying plans for flying machines. He filled notebooks with diagrams and pithy observations, set down without punctuation as his fingers flew across the pages. He also made some stunning portraits, including the mysterious La Belle Ferronnière, or the beautiful ironmonger's wife, painted on a wood panel. She was identified as Lucrezia Crivelli, lady-in-waiting to the Duchess of Milan, and one of the Duke's mistresses. What captivated me when I saw her portrait in the Louvre, not far from Mona Lisa's, was her unflinching gaze. What was it about Leonardo and the ladies he chose to paint that brought out such intensity? Was it the way Leonardo looked at women, or the way the woman looked at him? In Florence, an intense new voice began to emerge. The charismatic Fra Girolamo Savonarola was gaunt and gangly, with sunken cheeks and an enormous hooked nose. He saw evil in everyone around him. When he slipped out of his eminent family in Ferrara to join the Dominican order, he wrote, "I can no longer bear the wickedness of the people of Italy." As a prior in Florence at the monastery of San Marco, he began to preach like a human firebrand. He unleashed horrifying harangues that envisioned, in gruesome detail, the apocalyptic fate awaiting a town awash in sodomy, usury, and decadence of every sort. His timing was extraordinary. Encouraged by Milan's duke, King Charles VIII of France decided to invade Italy in order to seize the throne of Naples. Town after town yielded without a fight, and some 30,000 soldiers and mercenaries advanced on Florence. Savonarola told his increasing congregation that he had seen a fiery cross hanging in the dark clouds above Florence. God was unleashing his terrible sword to punish a city of sinners. Lorenzo de' Medici's three sons and their families fled the city with as many jewels and valuables as they could carry. At news of this, the priors declared the Medici banished forever and confiscated their assets. From his home on nearby Via della Stufa, Francesco del Giocondo would have heard a mob breaking into the Medici Palazzo and hauling off a fortune in priceless artifacts. The next morning, Florence's citizens awoke to a new reality. The Medici reign had ended. In November, Charles VIII rode into Florence unchallenged. During 11 days of occupation, the French were given vast sums of money before marching south. The leadership vacuum was filled by Savonarola, who declared the city's new monarch to be Jesus Christ. Preaching against luxury, he organized the Bonfire of the Vanities, when Florentines brought forth their valuables and their artworks to be burnt. A portrait of this event shows the preacher in a white robe, a black hood over his head and shoulders, his arm pointing to the upper right, as if to a new world and a new day. Francesco del Giocondo couldn't wait for its arrival. As history raged around him, the impatient widower wanted a wife as quickly as possible. His status demanded no less, and his little son would need a mother. Why, of all the girls in Florence he could have chosen, did he marry Lisa Gherardini? I put this to her dedicated archivist, Giuseppe Palanti, who refers to her in our conversation as La Nostra Donna, or Our Lady. Was it her beauty, her pedigree? He pauses for a moment, then pronounces two Latin words, ingenua mulier. The phrase appears in Francesco del Giocondo's will, drawn up the year before his death. It clearly means more than the literal noble wife. Would you say a free spirit, I ask him? It could be, he says, if you mean a woman of quality and presence, not only pretty, but with a noble spirit. Yes, I say, realizing that the adult Lisa is taking tangible form in my imagination. This is exactly what I mean. And Francesco del Giocondo, a rich man by any measure, could do without a large dowry. So he did what he always did. He went after what he wanted, and he clearly wanted Lisa.
Nancy Crean was reading from Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered by Diane Hales. The book was abridged by Eileen Horn and produced by Clive Brill. It's a Brill production for BBC Radio 4. This weekend, Mark Radcliffe joins BBC Radio 4 Extra to present 3 hours of comedy winners. His specially selected six-pack have all picked up various awards in their time and include a serving of a very famous sketch show.
Did you ever hear of the legend of the seeded fruit that is often mistaken for a vegetable?
The tomato.
Red in colour and fleshy within, but beware of the peps. They call it the tomato.
Little Britain, just one of Mark Radcliffe's comedy winners on Saturday morning at 9 and again in the evening at 7 over on BBC Radio 4 Extra. You're listening to BBC Radio 4.